So today, we begin with a new topic, the Bengal Delta, and the very character of the Bengal Delta, and how Bengal Delta and its character is historically so significant. As you know, that Bengal Delta is featured with the deltaic plains, that is flat. It is also marked by low-lying floodplains in the shape of huge horseshoe-like formation, where in the open part is faced by the Bay of Bengal. And if you look at the northeast, the northeastern side is featured with the mountain peaks. As I mentioned in my earlier lectures, that the Ganga, the Brahmaputra, and the Meghna rivers, they together made the Bengal Delta, which covered a huge part of the Ganges basin, the Ganga basin, which is the middle and the lower Ganga. And then you also have the Brahmaputra and the Meghna basin, overall, the Bengal Delta actually covers a huge section of Bengal, which included the eastern Bengal, that is modern-day Bangladesh, and also part of West Bengal zone. So now, all these rivers also have many tributaries. They were, you know, these tributaries, they acted as some kind of natural arteries of communication and transport. And even today, they are used as arteries of communication and network in this area. Now, but the very flow of these rivers, the many rivers and its tributaries, they also deposit immense amount of fertile soil, what we call a silt, every year. And this actually is very helpful for the agricultural fields. Iftikhar Iqbal had written very interestingly, a very, you know, very interesting feature of the Bengal Delta. In fact, his book is titled as Bengal Delta itself, which is an environmental history of Bengal Delta. And he has mentioned that some estimated 40,000 million cubic feet of silt actually settle in the Bengal Delta during their journey to the Bay of Bengal. So all these rivers which travel through the Bengal Delta, they deposit 40,000 million cubic feet of silt. So basically, the silt deposition and the land formation played a very important role, not only in the formation of the region, but also it had historical significance. And obviously, as I mentioned in my earlier classes, that it's not environmental determinism, it's not river determinism, it's not only that the river determines the human action. You know, what happens is that when there is a change in the course, there is a new landform, then humans in the historical past have reacted to these changes in different manners. And these are very, you know, they have reacted in very unpredictable manners. So in that sense, it's not actually the river determinism which is so significant for the region. It's not environmental determinism as a concept. So the deposition of huge silt creates enormous area of new land known as jors and dyaras. And the silt deposition process in the past have led to the formation of new lands, which gradually saw the growth of vegetation and plants, which later on turned into jungles. So much of this gradual increase of land was taking place in the eastern part of Bengal. And this was largely because of the fact that there has been, historically, there has been eastward movement of the Ganga when it actually started flowing, when it entered into Bengal, and then when it entered into eastern Bengal. So this eastward movement of the Ganga is so very significant. I'll show you the slides wherein how these rivers over the last three, four centuries have, especially the Ganga, has shifted, and it has shifted eastward, which has been proved by the historical maps that has been used by historians. Now, it is with this eastward movement of the Ganga that the huge area of Sundarbans emerged in the Bay of Bengal, and this happened at the fringes of the Bengal Delta. The new land formation in the eastern part of Bengal, it happened because there was a gradual eastward movement of the Ganga, and this is proven, and this is a proven fact, and this has been, very aptly, with lot of data and information, it has been proved by Richard Eaton, in if you read his book, The Rise of Bengal, The Rise of Islam in the Bengal Frontier. And he shows that how this eastward movement actually began in the 16th and the 17th centuries from the Hooghly-Bhagirathi channel towards the bed of Padma, which is obviously, as I mentioned, is the other name of Ganga in Bengal. The eastward shift of the Ganga ended when it met the river Jamuna, which is Brahmaputra, near this modern city of Dhaka, and this happened in the early 19th century. So look at these maps in the slides that I'm trying to show you. If you look at these maps that Richard Eaton has used as a historical evidence to suggest that there has been a gradual shift of the Ganga towards further east, and this led to the formation of new lands. So here are the three maps, four maps. There is one map of Bengal of 1548, which is of Gastaldi. The other is that of 1615, which is of de Barros. And then you have a map of 1660 by which was of Breke, and then you have another map which has been drawn by the historians of the Mughal period, and this is based on the description that is found in the various Mughal accounts. But then this is a modern map that Richard Eaton has used to suggest that even, if you read the Mughal account, they talk about the flow of the Ganga in this such manner. So there was no, absolutely no map that we have for the Mughal period, but obviously, and that was drawn, which was drawn by the Mughal chroniclers. There was no such thing, but the modern historians have actually created those maps based on the information that we have in the Mughal documents. But the most authentic one, the first most authentic map was drawn in 1779, that was drawn by Rennell. And this map is very interesting. And then if you look at this map, by that time the Ganges has shifted more towards east. Now, obviously, when I'm saying all this, this is a kind of a process of sedimentation which has played a very important role in the formation of these new lands. If you look at the coastal area of Bengal. As you know, that the process of sedimentation reaches its peak during the annual monsoon and the downpour, and also because of the melting of the glacier that takes place in the summer. So there is huge amount of water coming in from the hills, and then along with the river comes a lot of silt. So what happens that there are two things happening together. The ocean currents are, at that time when there is huge flow, it is impeded by the heavy down, this outflow from the rivers. And in turn, it deposits a huge amount of sand in the coastal region. So thus, a double process of land making continues amidst the mutual confrontation of silt-laden rivers and then the sand-carrying sea. The very formation of land and has encouraged the various species that we find in the mangroves. So mangrove has various species of plants and vegetation, and which has also facilitated the consolidation of shorelines. Even the later maps which were drawn during the British period, they are very, they are very clear about the flow of the Ganges and how the Ganges is now flowing very close to Dhaka. Now, this we have already discussed about these new lands which were formed in the historical past. But then as a history student, we need to understand that if there has been such kind of changes in nature in this entire region, is there any historical significance? And Richard Eaton has written a very interesting book called The Rise of Islam in the Bengal Frontier. And in this book, he mentions about the contemporary version of the residents of a city called Lucknowthi of early modern times of medieval times. And this was basically a city in northwestern part of Bengal. So he mentions that at that time the contemporary historian Minhaj Zuzani, he mentions about a very dramatic event. And he says that Minhaj in fact mentions that he was told by the residents of that area that there was some kind of a dramatic event of some 40 years earlier. And Minhaj in fact writes that in his Tabqat al-Asri, and that he was informed that a band of some hundreds of Turkic cavalry, they had ridden the entire Mid-Ganga plain and then entered into this part of Lucknowthi. So they looting and then confiscating the properties, the various structures. This Turkic band moved in the direction of Bengal Delta. And obviously, you know the story of, and you've heard the story of this band which I'm talking about is a band of Muhammad Bakhtiar Khalji. Now, he and his men overran various Buddhist monasteries in Bihar. So there are historians who, many of them argue that this kind of the destruction of the Buddhist monastery, especially Nalanda, was not done by Bakhtiar. But I think, most of the historical accounts mention the that the Nalanda University at that time, which was a huge university, and it is believed that there were huge depository of manuscripts there. They were actually destroyed by Bakhtiar. Now, from there, Bakhtiar turned his attention to northwestern portion of Bengal. And it was at that time being ruled by a Hindu monarch. And what happens that that disguise, he, you know, Bakhtiar, he disguised himself as a horse dealer. And then he and his men slipped into the royal city of Nadia at that time, which was a very important city, which was capital of the Hindu monarch there. So when they enter inside, then they enter into King's palace, and they, you know, they now brandish their weapon, they take out their weapons, and then the local Hindu king had just couldn't understand it. It happened so fast. Now, after this incident, obviously the Hindu monarch abandoned his kingdom altogether, and then after that, Bakhtiar ruled the area. Now, this coup obviously inaugurated a new era, and for almost next 5 centuries, we see that most of the area of Bengal was dominated by rulers who followed Islam. So what is remarkable is the fact that in Bengal, you have a majority of indigenous population who are the followers of followers of non-Islamic faith. They are followers of Buddhism, they are followers of Vaishnavism, they are followers of many other, you know, religious sects, followers of, you know, the Brahmanism. But then you will find that this region has been ruled by the Bengal sultans after Bakhtiar Khalji. But why is it that the population of the majority population of Bengal, despite the Sultanate rule, and if I'm talking about Sultanate, it's not Delhi Sultanate, it's about the Bengal Sultanate. So despite this Bengal Sultanate rule, there has not been much Islamization which had taken place in the medieval period. Now this outcome of the very establishment of the Bengal Sultanate, it proved to be a very deciding factor in the 20th century. And when in 1947, after independence, when India was divided into two independent states, India and Pakistan, and you know that this partition was done, and the very basis of this partition was the distribution of Indian, this Hindu and Muslim population. Now, its repercussion was left, it left a permanent mark not only for the northwestern part of India, because then you have Pakistan and then you have India based on the population. But its repercussion was also felt in Bengal. And the area with which had a Muslim majority in 1947 was called the Eastern Wing of Pakistan. So it was known as Eastern Pakistan. And later you find that there was a war in 1971. And then with the help of Indian army, Eastern Pakistan was declared independent as Bangladesh. The part of the province where you had the Hindu majority, which had a very in Muslim population, this became the state of West Bengal and which remained part of India. Now, I'm talking about this entire Bengal region, but it is very interesting that the hub of the Bengal Sultanate rule was the modern day West Bengal. But despite that, in 1947, you see that the population of that region was largely that of the Hindus. Now, this is a very significant historical fact, which for the historian, it forces him to investigate this very reality, very fact, the very data. In fact, we have a figures which has been provided by Eaton, he says that in 1984, about 93 million of the total 152 million of Bengalis in Bangladesh and West Bengal, they were Muslims. And of the estimated some 96.5 million people inhabiting Bangladesh, 81 million people were Muslims. So this constitutes, you know, Bangladesh in 1984, which had this huge population, 83% of the population was that of the Muslims. So in fact, Bengalis today comprise the second largest Muslim ethnic population in the world, after the Arabs, obviously. So it's very interesting. So there are a few very important, pertinent questions that arise before us as a student of history, because this is a very interesting fact. When you have a, because the fact is that there was not much conversion which had taken place in Bengal, the West Bengal area, whereas in East Bengal area, which was actually a new land formed after the 17th century, right? So in this new land, there has been historically more a population of those people who were the followers of Islam. Now, you know, as a natural thing, it would have been very easy for the Hindus or the Brahmanical faith or Vaishnavism or Shaivism, it would have been easier for these faiths to expand into even the newly formed land. But it never happened. So now this makes us to inquire into this very reality, that when new lands have been formed, why is it that the Hindus have not migrated to those areas? Why it is that most of the people living in those areas became Hindus? Rather, they became the followers of Islam. So how can one explain this development? Why did such a large Muslim population emerge in Bengal, which was so distant from the Middle East, from which Islam historically actually expanded, and not in other regions of India? So you see the the huge distance. You have a huge patch of area, huge area between the Middle East and obviously the Northwest also, if you look at the Northwest region where you have the Muslim population. And there is a huge patch of land which is where the majority of the population is that of the Hindus. And then suddenly you have a pocket where you have the Muslim population. Now, within Bengal, why is it that the Islamization occurs at so much greater pace? So, was there some historical development which had led to the conversion, and why did it happen? At what time did it all happen? So it is a challenge for the historian, because as I mentioned that if you look at the Mughal accounts, it would appear that the Bengal Sultanate had been established, and possibly because of the establishment of the Bengal Sultanate, there has been expansion of the faith. But when you read other documents, it is not a reality. It suggests that it's not because of the establishment of the Bengal Sultanate rule that the Muslim population or the Muslim faith has expanded in the Bengal Delta. So Bengal's history is extraordinary, not only because of the widespread Islamization that had occurred, but also because of its frontier character. And if we look at the history of Turkic rulers and their movement from northwest area, it began in the 13th century. So they gradually moved eastward, right? And the new Islams, this newly Islamicized Turkic soldiers, because you must have been taught in various other papers that how the Turkic soldiers were first Islamicized, and then from Central Asia and Iranian plateau, they provided some kind of a ready supply of soldiers for the Delhi sultans and the Sultanate officers. So these men, these Turkic men, they moved on horseback, and they pushed they pushed themselves to at least to that area where there was no geographical barriers. But they could not move in the northeast. That was because that was surrounded by mountains, and they could not go beyond the southern part of Bengal, because you had the Bay of Bengal there, and you just can't enter into the sea. That was a limitation of these Turkic soldiers. So Bengal was the terminus of Turco-Mongol conquest and their migration. So Bengal, in that sense, was a kind of a frontier zone. So Bengal also possessed three, different kinds of frontiers, and that's a very interesting thing that Richard Eaton mentions in his book. So he talks about, three kinds of frontiers: the political frontiers, the agrarian frontiers, and then the religious frontiers. Now, when he talks about the political frontier, he says that it is actually an area which define the territories within which the Turk or the Bengal sultans, or later even the governors of the Mughal Empire, they actually they garrisoned themselves there. They garrisoned the troops there. They collected revenue there. They, in fact, also let you heard of the Bengal Sultan minting coins. But then it all this was a this was the limit of their expansion, because after Bengal Delta they couldn't expand because of the geographical barriers. The second frontier that he talks about is the agrarian frontier, which divided the settled agricultural communities from the forest communities. And then the third one is the religious, which divided the Muslims from the non-Muslim communities. Now, all these three frontiers were superimposed on the older, what he terms as a Sanskritic civilization in Bengal. It was characterized as obviously, when I'm talking about the Sanskritic civilization, which Eaton uses the term. So this Sanskritic civilization was it included both the Buddhist institutions and the various Brahmanical institutions. So you have both these these faiths which comprised the Sanskritic civilizations. So Sanskritic civilization in both its Buddhist and the Brahmanic forms, they had gradually moved down the Gangetic plain into the Bengal Delta gradually. And it happened it was a long drawn process. And it all happened even before Bakhtiar appeared in Bengal. Obviously, a very different nature was of the Bengal's agrarian frontier, because it divided the deltas, the huge cultivable terrain of flatland, which was more stable, and it was slow moving, and it shaped the very movement of the humans. Now, when it comes to the political frontier, it was man-made, and it was obviously subject to the rapid movement. But if you look at the agrarian frontier, it was much more stable, right? So that's something which we have to understand and realize. The most outstanding of the natural forces was obviously that we have been talking about and we have been emphasizing on is the movement of the rivers of Bengal. And in the long run, it led to the decay of northwestern and western delta, because the river channel shifted increasingly eastwards. The impression that we get from the contemporary population distribution in Bengal Delta, as I mentioned just now, is that the rise of Muslim communities in Bengal was a corollary to the expansion of the Turkic rule. But the fact is that a large number of Bengali Muslims did not emerge immediately after Bakhtiar's rule. And this is based on the other sources that I'm talking about, the other archives that we have used to understand this. So if you read the mainstream sources, if you read the Persian accounts, it would appear that the faith of Islam expanded along with the Turkic expansion and with the Mughal expansion. But this is not the fact if you read the other sources. So Bengal's frontier, because it's a frontier, this frontier also moved by its own dynamics. So all these frontiers that we just mentioned, the political frontier, the agrarian frontier, and the religious frontier, they overlapped one another in different ways. For instance, after having established a base in northwestern part of Bengal area, which remained the epicenter of the Bengal Sultanate rule, or the Turkic power then moved swiftly to the revenue-rich southwestern part of Bengal. The rulers here encountered a dense agrarian society. It was a dense population. But the conquest of the Turks of this huge area, which was very revenue-rich area, it did not involve the physical extension of the arable land. So it was actually just some kind of a control of the local revenue structure. So the idea was to collect the revenue. Idea was not to expand the faith. On the other hand, in much of the eastern and southern part of Bengal Delta, where the field agriculture had not yet replaced thick forests, the political and the agrarian frontiers that we just talked about, they actually came together. And the territorial expansion of the Turkish rule and their domination, it generally stopped at the edge of the forest. So it was only when the forests were cleared that they further expanded into that area. So in other words, what is happening in this part of Bengal is that the expanding Turkic force or the Turkic rule, it involved both the incorporation of the indigenous population into the Islamic fold, and also it's the physical transformation of the land from just a marshy or a forest land into the rice field. Now, both these things are occurring simultaneously, but is the more important fact is that we can talk about the expansion of the agrarian territory in the area after clearing of the forest, but is it also happening simultaneously with the expansion of the Islamic faith? Now, if you look at the history of Bengal Delta, the contact between Indo-Aryan civilization and the Delta region. Just a minute. So the contact I was mentioning, the contact that has happened in historical past between the gradual movement of the Aryan civilization into eastern part of India. And the Delta region also, I mean, obviously the entire Indo-Aryan civilization then expanded into the Delta region. This did not coincide only with the rise of imperial state. I mean, this kind of an expansion has also happened along with the expansion of Buddhism. And you've seen that in ancient times, this entire ancient period, right from the 3rd century BC to the 8th century AD, there was an expansion of the Buddhist faith in this area. So, in contrast to the hierarchical vision of Brahmanism, which talked about the which had this very nature of social exclusion and ritual purity, it was because of this limitation of the Brahmanism that Buddhism had emerged. And you know that this has been written by many historians. So what Buddhism offered before the people was an egalitarian and very egalitarian kind of a society, and this permitted Buddhism to expand over a huge area of new land. So there was a horizontal expansion of the Buddhist faith during this entire period, and that's why even the emperors like Ashok or all these emperors they also became the followers of Buddhism. They in fact went on to establish Buddhism as an imperial cult. So the positive evidence of this kind of an expansion of Buddhism in Bengal is not found until the 2nd century BC, because it was only after that period when you have a stupa at Sachi being constructed in Madhya Pradesh, but then it if you look at the supporters, the list of the supporters of that stoop, you also have the Bengalis in the list. So even one of the inscriptions of Andhra Pradesh, which was found at Nagarjunakonda, it mentions about Bengal as an important Buddhist region. And this inscription is of the 5th century AD. In fact, many of the Chinese pilgrims or the travelers, they have mentioned about Bengal as an important center of Buddhism. So Buddhism in Eastern India had actually entered very early, and it evolved into an imperial cult, which was obviously patronized by many later by rulers and by traders and also by many administrators. Now, rather than Buddhism, you know, there was also obviously when Buddhism was expanding, the Brahmanism or you know the Brahmanical faith was not sitting ideal. It also then improvised itself. So, in fact, D.D. Kaushambi has mentioned in his book that at that time when Buddhism was expanding so rapidly, Brahman rituals were at that time accompanied by a you know practical calendar. So they came up with some kind of metrology, and they gave sound working knowledge of agricultural techniques, which was unknown to many of the primitive tribal groups. So Kaushambi was in fact one of the first historians to observe that the major historical change in ancient India was not between the dynasties that were coming in, but it was in the advance of the agrarian village settlements over the new lands, the new tribal lands, that where the most of the happenings are taking place. All of this, all these developments were underway in the 5th century AD also and afterwards. And it continues till the Bengal Sultanate had been established. As you know that the Palas emerged as an important rulers in Bengal and you know eastern part of India, especially from the 8th century AD, and they were the Buddhist followers. The very founder of the Pala Empire was his name was Gopal. He was also a very fervent Buddhist follower, and they in fact had also a very powerful ruler later on known as Dharmpal, who even took the territory of the Pala Empire down to the Kannauj area in Mid-Ganga Basin. So under the patronage of the Palas and even various other dynasties that emerged, Buddhism received a tremendous support. And in fact, because of this support that Buddhism expanded even throughout the maritime Asia. So it you know went beyond the Indian subcontinent. In fact, Dharmpal himself patronized the construction of two very famous monuments, the monasteries, the Vikramshila in you know as you know in eastern Bihar, and then the Paharpur of Bengal's Rajshahi district. So when there was a expansion of commercial activity in eastern India in the 8th century, Buddhism as a state cult spread in the you know neighboring areas also. So it went beyond beyond the Indian subcontinent. It entered into Tibet, it entered into Burma, it went to Cambodia and Java also. So, and then you see that various Buddhist monies, Buddhist shrines were constructed in those areas. And these were all modeled on the prototypes that were developed in Bengal and Bihar at that time. But what happens is by 11th century, the earlier this kind of support that was being given by the Pala rulers to Buddhism, it then shifted towards two Brahmanical cults, associated with Shiva and Vishnu. This shift was actually it's very difficult to figure out the shift on the basis of the written accounts. But if you look at the archaeological evidences, it is proven that how the Palas had made a shift from Buddhism to the sects of Vaishnavism and Shaivism. I visited 2 years back the museum, the newly constructed museum of Bihar, that is in Patna, and I took photograph a few of the excavated material of that area of Bengal region, and we find that this kind of a transition, the shift of religious faith and support, is evident from the evidences that we get in these museums. So if you look at the many of the icons that have been found in excavation, they are all belonging to the 10th and 11th century. The 10th and 11th century is dominated by such icons of bodhisattvas, the female bodhisattvas and the male. But the moment you enter into the 12th century, the monuments, that the kind of icons that you get is that of Vishnu and the related Vaishnavism faith. So this kind of a shift is actually very interesting, and this is something which we must try to understand, and this is a kind of a reflection also of the later development that has taken place. Now, mind you, that the very support of the ruler has not led to the expansion of Buddhism to the larger community into Buddhism in this area. Now, when the later Pala ruler realized this, that the more popular cult among the larger population is that of Vishnu, they then adapted themselves to the much popular faith, and they became the followers of, they started promoting Vaishnavism. And these trends are seen very clearly in the later Bengali dynasties, like the Varmans who came to rule and the Senas who became the later rulers who dominated the Bengal at that time, when the Muslim conquest actually took place. So as the Pala power declined, declined by the early 12th century itself, when the Senas come to rule, and they occupy the territory earlier controlled by the Palas, they consolidated their base mainly in this entire Bhagirathi Hooghly area, and then gradually they moved to the eastern part. But then the Senas had come from South India, but they had a fierce devotion to Hindu culture. So they, along with them came also the faith of Saivism. Now, that's why, you know, the shifts that we see, in which is evident in these artistic record that I just showed you, these artifacts, the icons that we get in the archaeological excavation, are also telling us that there has been a shift in the support of particular faith in the 12th century. So along with the political changes, there were also religious changes taking place in the Bengal Delta. You know, this kind of a transformation that we have just talked about, the eastern edge of the delta is having a huge area of land, which was obviously in the earlier stages, which was uncultivated land, and in the long process of making these uncultivable land into the cultivable ones, it was given as grants to groups of Brahmins and Buddhist monasteries. And the very idea was to, you know, colonize these lands and bring these lands into cultivation. So in the between 8th and the 11th century, you will find that most of these lands have been given as grants to the Buddhist monasteries. But the moment the Sena ruler come, the grants are being given now to the Brahmins. If you look at the records of the grants that were given, in the Bhagirathi Hooghly region, most of the land grants in the 12th century are being made to the individual Brahmins. After the 9th century, the royal donation in this area was also, you know, this also to the Brahmins, but it was not very huge. Now, this kind of a expansion of land, cultivable land that was taking place, it was very common. So, you know, there was a peasantization process that had taken place in Bengal during these early centuries, and it happened with the help of the Buddhist and the Brahmanical faiths, through the monasteries as institutions and through the Brahmins as individuals. Now, so Richard Eaton overall argues that the Buddhist monastic establishments were so central to the religious institutional survival that when it lost any patronage from the state, you know, it disintegrated. So Brahmanism was more popular at the local level, and so you know, later the Pala rulers realized its popularity, and they began favoring the cult of, you know, the two gods of Shiva and Vishnu. And that is why, you know, most of the art patronized by the Pala kings of the 20th century was of Brahmanic and even of the Senas, was the subject was of Brahmanic matter and was having Vaishnava themes. With the presentization of Bengal, the epicenter of power in Eastern India shifted from Bihar to Bengal. So the moment you see that there has been an expansion of further land, you know, all cultivable land to cultivable ones, the epicenter has shifted to Bengal proper. And the evidences from early medieval period indicate that Bengal's northwest and western sub-regions, where they were more deeply influenced by the Hindu civilization. And if this is based on the fact that I'm talking about in comparison to the Eastern Delta, which remained less peasantized and less Hinduized. So there are evidences of grants of uncultivable land in Eastern Delta to the groups of Brahmins and Buddhist monasteries to colonize the land and to bring it into cultivation. In West Bengal, the situation was different. Different because the land grants here were given to individual Brahmins and they were small in size, and the land grants were attached with taxes in kind or cash. Now, obviously, there are several reasons for the greater penetration of the Brahmanical faith into the western part of Bengal, because it was closer to the Midganga. Number one, obviously, the fact is that it was closer to the Midganga plain, which was peasantized first. Then the wet rice cultivation began in West Bengal first. If you look at the other factors, like, you know, the climate of West Delta was more suitable to the settlement. So, and if you look at the monsoon rainfall patterns in this part of West Bengal, it has some 50 to 55 inches of rainfall. But the moment you move towards further east into Bengal, so the eastern part of Bengal had very higher rainfall. So somewhere between 120 to 150 inches. Now, because of this rainfall pattern, the eastern delta is obviously it was covered with thick forest. But during the 16th century and afterwards, the eastward movements of Bengal rivers caused the northwest delta to decay. So as river system gave access to new tracts of land and deposited on them the huge amount of silt, these newly silted area were now transformed into rice fields. And this provided the basis for new agrarian communities. The ecological transformation that took place between these centuries of 17th, 18th, it also coincided with the Mughal expansion in Bengal. So the period is also seen during the same period, a substantial increase in population. Now, this increase in population then also coincides with the conversion of people into Islamic faith. So paradoxically, the conversion and the emergence of Bengali Muslims, it took place under a regime that did not, as a matter of policy, promote conversion. So it's very interesting, because the Mughals, as a matter of policy, then they did not believe in the expansion of religious faith. So how is it happening? This is something which we would be investigating deeply later on. But you know, the emphasis of today's lecture has been that how the Bengal Delta has been such an important frontier zone in terms of, you know, the in terms of polity, in terms of agrarian expansion, in terms of religion. So, you know, all these characters of society are make this Bengal Delta as a frontier zone. So I end my lecture today by saying this, but then when we meet next week, we'll be talking about the exposed zone hypothesis given by Lieberman, because that is very significant when we are talking about this kind of an expansion, agrarian expansion or the other kinds of expansion. Lieberman came up with a new hypothesis. Now we will check whether Lieberman's hypothesis is correct when we talk about the eastern India, especially Bengal Delta and Mid-Ganga section. So we'll be discussing all that in the next lecture.